one of those on unless it shows up in class.
All right, let's get started.
Petering out.
While all of these wars and problems of the 17th century were going on, the 17th century was nonetheless one of the most creative ages that we have looked at. It was an age which saw an incredible number of major philosophers appear on the scene: Francis Bacon, Descartes, Leibniz, Spinoza, and so on. But it was also an age when the arts flourished to an extraordinary degree. It's the age of Rembrandt, Rubens, Velasquez, Bernini, on and on, name almost anyone there, 17th century. But above everything else, it is, I suppose, the age of science. This is the period in which the modern science really gets off the ground for the first time. And the sciences that are explored first in this period are exactly the same pair that were explored earliest in the whole history of mankind that we know about, that is, astronomy and mathematics. Astronomy, of course, in its new version, begins back in the mid-16th century with Copernicus. Copernicus wrote that famous book of his, which was published just after his death, and which was dedicated to the papacy, in which he develops the theory that, in fact, the Earth is not the center of our universe, but that the Sun is, and that the Earth and the other planets travel around the Sun. Now, this is not a totally new theory. This had, in fact, been developed among the Greeks, but among the Greeks, this theory had given way to the Ptolemaic concept that the Earth was the center of everything. And that concept fitted in absolutely perfectly with Christianity, so it had never been questioned. And now, in the mid-16th century, Copernicus brought up the concept that the Sun is the center, and that the Earth revolves on an axis, and the planets revolve around the Sun. Now, he also thought they revolved in perfectly circular patterns, the circle being the most perfect of all geometric forms, and, indeed, that the Moon, for instance, was a perfect sphere, and so on. Now, this was published, indeed, with a kind of introduction, which was not written by Copernicus, but stated that this was only a hypothesis, not to be viewed as fact. And it was widely read, and it was immediately attacked by Martin Luther. Martin Luther attacked it on the basis that the Bible is revealed truth. And in the Bible, it says very plainly that Joshua commanded the sun to stand still, not the earth. Ergo, it's the sun that moves and not the earth, and Copernicus is dim-witted fool. The next person to attack this was, in fact, Calvin, who quoted from the Psalms, again to prove that the earth was stable and that the sun moved around the earth. Indeed, Catholicism was a late third in its final attack on the Copernican theory. Nonetheless, other people began discussing this, and a man named Tycho Brahe, a Swede, who had extraordinary eyesight, began making a series of observations of the heavens in which he expected to prove that Copernicus was wrong. Now, as yet, there is no such thing as a telescope, so you depend, in fact, on your own eyesight. Tycho Brahe was hired by the Emperor Rudolf down in Prague as court astronomer, because, in fact, astrologer, because, in fact, astrology and astronomy have not yet split apart. And Tycho Brahe managed to start a famous star chart in which he himself located over 900 fixed stars and began, indeed, this study and mapping of the heavens, which has continued ever since. Now, when he died, his work was continued by a man named Kepler. Kepler did not have as great eyesight as did Tycho Brahe, but he had all of Tycho Brahe's observations with which to work, and he did continue the star map. and indeed increased the number on that to over 1,100 that were charted eventually in the Rudolphine tables. But he discovered by using these observations that, in fact, Copernicus was right in some ways and wrong in some, because the planets did seem to revolve around the sun all right, but they didn't go in perfect circular paths at all. They went in elliptical paths. So you moved on now through observation to another stage. And this began to prove the Copernican theory. But the great figure is, of course, basically a 17th century man, and this is Galileo. Galileo has a telescope. He didn't invent the telescope. The telescope was invented up in Holland, and it was, in fact, not at all powerful. It was a little like using a bad pair of opera glasses in its first stage. But Galileo learned the system, made his own telescopes, and in fact improved the range of the telescope rather extraordinarily in his own lifetime. Now, Galileo did with this observations that tended, in fact, to prove the Copernican theory absolutely. He did note sunspots, and sunspots were able to prove that the sun revolves on an axis. He also discovered the moon was anything but a perfect sphere. It was pocked with all kinds of craters and mountain ranges and all kinds of things like this. He discovered a couple of the moons of Jupiter, which also revolved around that planet. And all of this, indeed, now established the Copernican theory almost beyond any question. Now, he published this, of course, and now the church suggested that he not publish anything more along these lines. And Galileo continued his labors and finally decided some years later that, in fact, he would be able to get around the fact that the church disapproved of this by getting into theology and explaining those elements in the Bible which seemed not to accept this particular theory. So he published that. Now, that's what got him in trouble, in fact. He is called before the papal inquisition, and he is forced to recant and to say that these are no longer true. There is an old legend which says that at that final moment after recanting, he mutters under his breath, "Et pur si muove," which means it moves just the same. But that is only later legend, I'm afraid, and only occurs in the literature many years later. He was briefly imprisoned, then he is allowed to go to Siena, and finally to return to Florence, where he's protected by the Medici Grand Dukes. And in fact lives out the rest of his life there with a reputation of being one of the foremost intellects in all of Europe. Now, he discovers other things as well. I might add that this whole Copernican theory does not receive its capstone until late in the 17th century when Newton discovers the theory of gravitation. And it is through the theory of gravity that he explains how and why the planets are held in these particular orbits and how they operate as they do and why the moon should affect the tides of the seas on this earth and so on. That does, in fact, create the capstone in the 17th century on this particular view. Now, that's one aspect. The other thing that comes up in the 17th century is an extraordinary new concept of mathematics. Mathematics is absolutely essential to the 17th century. It's notable that for the first time they work algebra into a universal system in which you have the first letters of the alphabet representing known numbers and X, Y, and Z unknowns and so on, and this codifies the whole algebraic system. Beyond that, they get very deeply into analytical geometry, particularly with the philosopher Descartes, who was a notable mathematician. And beyond that, by the end of the century, two separate persons have both invented calculus, apparently independently. These are Newton and the German philosopher Leibniz. Now, there is an awful argument over which he invented it first, and it continues. If you read English scholarship, it is Newton. If you read German, it is Leibniz. Certain it is that Leibniz published it first, but at the same time, Newton then proceeded to produce things written many years before on his theory. He called it fluxions, which indicated, in fact, that he had developed this before Leibniz got started. So it's more than possible that Newton is the first person to develop calculus. Now, the importance of the new mathematics is basic, because the kind of mathematics that had been developed by the Greeks and the Romans, that is, classical mathematics, deals only with static things. And it does not take into consideration infinity. In fact, the Greeks have a kind of abhorrence of the idea of infinity. And everything is dealt as though it is absolutely motionless and is seen in this particular guise. Now, this is the kind of mathematics which existed up to the 17th century. Only when you start developing these new forms, particularly calculus, and I might add that logarithms are developed in the 17th century as well, that you get the introduction of motion into mathematics and the ability of mathematics to deal with the concept of motion itself. Now, this is extraordinarily important, because for the first time now, the universe is thought of as not being something static, but something dynamic and something in motion. And the whole concept of motion becomes one of those key concepts to the entire century. It is one of those dominant thoughts, and in one form after another, motion now begins to be studied. Indeed, up to this time, motion had not been understood at all well. It's Galileo, for instance, who studies out the trajectory of such things as artillery shells, cannonballs, things like this. Up to this time, in fact, they have just simply pointed it point blank at something and fired. Now, indeed, if you've got a castle to try to hit, you can hardly miss this way, it's true. Though your fire may not be as accurate as you expect. But nonetheless, now they discovered that projectiles follow an elliptical path, not a straightforward or circular or anything like this, so that you could begin to use artillery far more effectively than before. This, you see, is a problem of motion that you get into here. So that motion affects all kinds of things, from war on through the highest realms of philosophy. It becomes absolutely fundamental. Now, those two things put together, the new astronomy, the new dynamics, the new concept of math, tended to involve almost all thought. Every major philosopher of the 17th century is a mathematician. Some of them are great mathematicians, and some of them aren't very good mathematicians, but they're all mathematicians. And all of them feel that the only way that you can hope to understand the world and the way it operates is through applying the same kind of logical thought that goes into mathematics itself. So that they talk about mathematical thought, or thinking arithmetically. Things of this type enter into the thought processes as a major part of it. In addition to this, they begin to develop in the 17th century an enormous number of the basic tools of science. Now, math is certainly one of those, and the telescope is another basic tool. But, for instance, Galileo develops the concept of the pendulum. He's the person who works out the theory of how a pendulum operates, and he does this after having looked at a huge lamp in the Cathedral of Pisa, which swings very slightly, always in the same time. Now, once he had developed the theory of a pendulum, what it meant was that later in the century, a Dutchman named Huygens is the first one to apply this to a machine that measures time. The pendulum clock is invented. Now, the importance of the pendulum clock, of course, is simply this, that for the first time they had a system for measuring time which could measure very small fragments of time. Up to this time, you could measure larger chunks, but you couldn't measure fractions of a minute or of a second. It takes a pendulum clock to do this. So, this now gives them another tool, a tool to measure time. They also, of course, get into other forms of measurement. Notably, for instance, they developed the barometer. This was by putting a hollow tube down in various substances, finally mercury, and discovering that the substance rises always to the same level, but that level fluctuates. And in fact, when it was first developed by Torricelli, he knew he was measuring something. But in fact, he wasn't sure for some time precisely what it was that he was measuring here. And it is the philosopher Pascal up in France who performs experiments with the barometer and discovers that what it is measuring, in fact, is air pressure. Now, once air pressure has been developed, you then can tie this, of course, into climate, into pressures of air, development of storms, rain, so on, and you get a barometer. They also were to develop, in the course of the 17th century, the thermometer. For the first time, they could measure degrees of heat. And, of course, the great and, I suppose, other fundamental discovery is the microscope. Now, the microscope, like the telescope, simply opened up a totally new world. You could see things which had never, never been seen before. And it came very close to blowing the educated minds of the 17th century wide open. Everybody who could have one wanted a microscope. And everyone had all kinds of new things to look at. It was absolutely incredibly fascinating. No one had ever seen it before. So for the first time, you looked at all the funny little thingies in swamp water, the funny little thingies in a drop of blood, the funny little thingies in snot. You looked at everything. Completely. A whole new world, and people are busy developing all kinds of new descriptions of what they have seen, what they have found, figuring out how it works. And all kinds of new sciences are opened up as a result of this. Indeed, science takes off so completely in this century that, for instance, in the 15th and 16th century, if you were a ruler, what you kept at court was apt to be a philosopher, a poet or two, an astrologer, and a couple of artists. From the 17th century on, what you keep in the back room is a scientist with some microscopes. And this becomes something that is of vital importance. Now, all kinds of things evolve out of what is found in the microscope. It's notable, for instance, that in the 17th century, it's the English doctor Harvey who finally develops the concept of the circulation of the blood and who figures out precisely how the heart works. Indeed, they had had it just backward up to this time, and while people had known that blood moved in the body, they had not been thoroughly sure of the difference between veins and arteries. For one thing, if you spend your time anatomizing cadavers, they don't tell you much about blood. It's drained out before you get started. You've got all those funny little tubes. And they weren't sure. Some people thought arteries were, in fact, for the movement of a kind of ethereal spirit that moves back and forth. And they worked out on all kinds of things. Eventually, even in the 16th century, it had been thought by some persons that the lungs had something to do with this, but they couldn't figure out the circulation problem. Now, Harvey figured out, in fact, almost entirely how the blood operates through the body, how it circulates. But he could not, in fact, figure out how you get the blood finally from the arteries into the veins. He could figure out all of the system except this. Now, it required a microscope, in fact, to work out that last link. And this was done by an Italian named Malpighi, who studied the membranes of a frog's webbing. And there he discovered capillaries. Now, it is, of course, that very fine capillary system, which is the system through which blood is transferred from arteries into veins, then it goes up through the lungs, heart, and so on. All of this. Now, with the discovery of capillaries, again, the system becomes perfect, in other words. So that medicine and the knowledge of how the body works begins to get off to a whole new set of operations. It did not, in fact, make medicine immediately an awful lot better. I must admit this. Doctoring is improving in the 17th century, but it has still got a long way to go. The theory of most doctors is, in this period, if you have a migraine headache, you open a vein and take blood. If you have a fever, you open a vein and take blood. If you have chills, you open a vein and take blood. If you've got tuberculosis, you open a vein and take blood. And indeed, if they do this often enough, run into some real problems. And so that they almost inevitably begin with this, and they still indeed believe that patients as a whole should be kept in a tightly enclosed room. They did not know how disease is passed from one person to another. And there were, it's true, some doctors, even in the 17th century, who said that you should open the windows and get fresh air into these stuffy sick rooms. But he was considered, well, odd, and perhaps not terribly reliable here. So, doctoring, and they use all kinds of weird things that they, you know, pigeon shit and blood and things like this to smear on you in hopes it will do something. They still, one of the greatest doctors of the 17th century, who is, in fact, the finest surgeon of the entire 30 years' war period, and the man who developed, in fact, a system for taking tiny bits of metal out of the eyeball by use of a magnet, and who is, indeed, a brilliant surgeon, nonetheless believed in sympathetic magic in this. So that, for instance, if you had been cut by a sword, then you bind the sword up and put it to bed to get well in hopes that this will improve you as well. And this is serious in the 17th century. This is one of the finest doctors of the whole period. It is a period, indeed, still, in which doctors are primarily dealing, of course, with herbs and things like this, and where surgeons are, in fact, the very bottom of the level. They are barber surgeons, and they are hired primarily to draw blood, things of this nature, use leeches to draw blood, cupping to draw blood, nicking a vein to draw blood. There are lots of ways to get the blood out of a person. And, in fact, it's going to be a very long time before surgeons have any social or financial clout in this world, though by God they have made it today. Nonetheless, so you don't have even progress, is what I'm getting at, in terms of the sciences here, but you get a number of extraordinary breakthroughs that do occur. And you do, for instance, begin to get chemistry off to a start with Robert Boyle in England. It's notable that up to this time, there has been a general concept that all things are made up, basically, of earth, air, fire, and water, and that they all have four qualities, hot, cold, wet, and dry. And you sort out which of these they share, to which degree, and this determines what things are made of. And they believed that there were certain substances which could, in fact, transform them. Sulfur being one, mercury another. These are high in the trade of alchemists. Alchemists, of course, had as their chosen hope, they hope of turning base metal such as lead into gold. And in fact, so does Robert Boyle, though he's the founding father of chemistry. He gets a special law passed through English Parliament to permit the turning of base metals into rare metals in case he ever learns how to do this. He's the, I think, the 10th child of the Earl of Cork. But it is Robert Boyle who takes up the concept that if you must try to break things down into basic elements, that is, into those things which cannot be broken down into anything lesser. So he begins to understand what a chemical element is and what a chemical compound is. He also understands that a compound may be totally different from any of the elements which go into it. And he begins to sort out what we would call a chemical table of elements. Indeed, he isolates a number of these and is successful in this. I might add that chemistry works very slowly. It only comes up in the later 17th century. It makes moves ahead sharply in the 18th century with Lavoisier and people like this. But one of the problems in chemistry is that until they isolated the elements and until they had symbols for them, there was no such thing as a universal language. In other words, it was next to impossible to accurately describe an experiment that you did so that someone else could repeat the experiment. And this is absolutely fundamental. As long, for instance, as all forms of acid are simply called vitriol, you're not off step one. Because if you don't know whether you're supposed to use sulfuric acid or hydrochloric acid, you've got real trouble on your hands, including things blowing up ever so often. So that you've got to work out a whole new language. Now, this is an enormous problem to work out. But the 17th century is the thing that begins this whole problem of starting the working out of a chemical language. And they do get into the concept of experimentation, experiments that can be written up, can be repeated, can be checked by various persons. All of this is now going on with some regularity in this century. And there are an enormous number of famous names that participate in this. Indeed, science becomes so important that after Charles II returns to England, what he does is to found a Royal Academy of the Sciences. Now, it's true that there had been a grouping of scientists before this who met, with some regularity, the so-called hidden college that existed here. But now it becomes the Royal Academy, supported by the state, and it is charged with, in fact, reading of scientific papers, the publication of scientific papers. In other words, science is given a kind of legality, a position, and funds to back it that comes out here. And the Royal Academy was instrumental in publishing all kinds of important things. Not things just written by them, but things done by foreign scholars. And indeed, scientists all over Europe are constantly in touch with each other. This becomes a whole kind of international world of its own. The English Royal Academy of Science is the first. It is followed by the French Royal Academy of the Sciences. But that one is never going to be quite as prominent as the English, largely because it is founded by Louis XIV's minister, Colbert. And Colbert's basic idea is that everything in the state ought to work to the advantage of the state. And he was not interested in pure science. What he wanted was the invention of machines, technology which would be useful to the state. And this is encouraged rather than pure science for its own sake, which was so prominent in the British Academy. So the French one tends to be more technologically oriented than does the British. Okay. Now, all of of these things include, in fact, all kinds of other fascinating discoveries. It's a German, von Guericke, who discovers the air pump so that you can create a vacuum or a near vacuum. And indeed, again, this is demonstrated in ways that pop the eyeballs of the 17th century. What he would do would be to take a couple of large copper hemispheres and put them together and then take the air out so the vacuum is created inside. Then there would be a team of horses attached to either end of these, and they would struggle and strive, but they couldn't pull them apart. Von Guericke would go up and open a path, let air in, and they would fall apart. Wow. Nonetheless, having in fact developed air pumps, they could begin to experiment with such things. Will flame burn in a vacuum, for instance? Does sound go through a vacuum? Does light go through a vacuum? All of these are experiments then of the 17th century. So the 17th century is particularly rich in this kind of work. And the 17th century then begins to take these ideas over into other concepts. Now, I've warned you that it's a great age for philosophy, and indeed, philosophy now tends to turn its back on the past and to look ahead. The philosophers again and again will state that they are beginning from scratch. Descartes is the most famous. Descartes tries to figure out what he is sure he knows. And he thinks, does he know anything about the world outside himself? And he decides, no, he doesn't. Because you can always be misled by your senses. He decides he doesn't know whether any of you exist or not. And then he tries to figure out, does he know he exists? Well, he's not sure he exists either. And he tries to find something he's sure of. And finally he finds it. Because he knows that the one thing he knows is that he is doubting. He's doubting everything. Doubting is thinking. So he knows that at least he is a thinking process. And that is where he begins. Cogito ergo sum. I think, therefore, I am. I finally got to me. And indeed, having arrived at this, he then, of course, because he's a firm Catholic, has to go on to the next stage, which is to try to prove the existence of God. And indeed, there is something of a leap of faith that takes place in Proposition 2 here. Because he works out the existence of God largely on this principle, that he can conceive of perfection. And he can conceive of perfection through what he knows about geometry. And he knows that he is not perfect, and nothing that he experiences is perfect. So that this concept of perfection, which he has, cannot come from his experience and cannot come from himself. Since all of this is imperfect. Therefore, it can only come from God, and this is the way, in fact, you prove the existence of God. Now, he offers some other proofs as well, the anthropological proof, but basically you work at this. Then he comes around to the concept that if God is perfect, and if God exists, God will not fool us. So, we can then trust our senses. And this gets me back to believing that you people actually exist and are sitting here in front of me on chairs. So, having arrived there, you take off, and he goes through and builds his philosophy on this. But the important factor is, A, that it uses a kind of mathematical process of thinking, and B, that it rejects the past and starts fresh. And this is going to be true of more and more of the philosophers. Francis Bacon, for instance, will believe that you have to ascertain everything through experimentation to make sure what it is, and you must build each fragment of knowledge together until you get enough of this that you are sure of now to be able to form a kind of basic hypothesis. This is a high level, and eventually intuition takes place. But indeed, that system of Francis Bacon would be so lengthy that had it been followed, we would still not be off square one today. Modern science did not use that, but instead used the concept of forming a hypothesis, which you then test, which is a shortcut, in fact, to get to things. Nonetheless, Bacon, again, is a thinker who is rejecting the past. And this continues on until you get toward the end of the century, persons who are beginning to come around to this kind of concept. Spinoza is one, Bale is another, for instance, who decide that it is clear that God has created a universe that operates around specific laws, physical laws, chemical laws, all of these factors. And that it is the job of man, then, to try to understand these laws through which God governs this earth. And to begin eventually to reach the point where the assumption is that God has created things which operate, in fact, according to an established series of laws, which it's our job to find out, and that once God has established this universe, which operates according to laws, it cannot be changed. God is not quixotic, in other words. And this means that by the end of the century, people are indeed coming to the opinion that there can be no such things as miracles. That miracles are indeed an interference in natural law, and that God is in fact bound by his own system. That once he has created it, he cannot change it or interfere. And they begin to attack older concepts on all kinds of levels. For instance, it had been believed from way, way back, as early as we know, that the appearance of a comet in the sky meant something. It meant something traumatizing. It meant either possibly that a great person had been born, Alexander the Great, or that a great person was going to be killed or die, or that there would be a catastrophe or a war, but it meant something big. So omens and portents were very much alive in thought still. And then along comes Henri Bayle, who says, nonsense. If God wanted to speak to us, surely he could speak more plainly than that. What kind of dopey idea is this you have of God? That he puts a comet up in the sky and then lets you guess what the hell this is all about. And he said, look at this great omen, for instance, of the gold tooth of the little girl in a Polish village. Now, all of a sudden, overnight, a very small girl in a Polish village had one tooth turned to solid gold in her head. Now, this created consternation in the village. Wow! And it attracted a lot of attention outside the village. Wow! And finally it attracted the attention of a lot of writers and thinkers, and they announced it was an omen. And what did it mean? Who had been born? Who was dead? What was going to happen? And finally, of course, after people had published an infinite numbers of answers to the little Polish girl's solid gold tooth, it was discovered, in fact, that it wasn't a solid gold tooth. It was, in fact, a hoax. The tooth had been covered with gold leaf, and that's all there was to it. So all of those portents and omens disappeared. So that indeed, what you are beginning to arrive at through all of this, by the end of the century, is an increasing concept of what we're going later to call a mechanical universe. In other words, a universe that operates according to established systems and which cannot be interfered with in any way. Something that it is now to our advantage to try to work out to understand these systems, and that if you understand these systems, you will then indeed be able to utilize it, and that in fact man's life on this earth will be enormously improved and better if you learn how these systems work and how to operate within them. you will then, in essence, have control of nature. Now, this is the beginning of a long process of thinking in, of course, the Western world. That's a fundamental shift from the past, because the past had, of course, essentially always prayed to God to do a miracle, to save you, to do something for you, all of these things. Now, God isn't going to perform any more miracles, in fact, and you are going to have to understand things and work them out yourself. But there is this marvelous kind of ebullient feeling that it's possible, that if you apply reason, you can, in fact, understand how everything works. You can control it. You can have a marvelous world if you just do all of this. So there's an enormous optimism that begins to operate here. And that optimism, of course, will go on for centuries. The very concept that, indeed, science is going to contain the answer to all human problems, if you just use it, work with it, find these out, is the thing which goes on through the 18th, through the 19th, into the 20th century. I would say offhand, right up to that golden moment where science produced the A-bomb, and we suddenly were confronted with the fact that science can produce monsters as well. And this was not in the cards. It has kind of taken the whipped cream off this feeling about science. But all of that starts here in the 17th century. And indeed, a whole series of doubts of the past, a kind of rejection of the past, begin here. It is one of those things which makes people feel that the 17th century is in many ways the real beginning of modern times. That in fact the 15th and 16th centuries are transitional ages between the Middle Ages and modern time. But all of a sudden, when science comes into its own, when you start rejecting the past and looking forward, this is what modern times is about. And they do get into and criticize everything. Indeed, the whole concept of the Bible as being revealed truth in every word comes under attack in this age as well. This had been accepted beyond any question through all the ages, along with a series of legends, including, of course, the concept that the first five books of the Bible were written by Moses. Now, it is a Frenchman named Richard Simon who points out that, in fact, the fifth one ends with an account of the death and burial of Moses, and it seems highly unlikely to him that Moses wrote that part of it, at any rate. And he begins to get into biblical criticism in this respect, and indeed, it creates shock waves of horror through the church at this time. Bossuet, who is the great leader of conservatism, is appalled by Richard Simon. And Bossuet, with very good sense, because Bossuet understands that if, in fact, you give way on any one point here, the whole thing can simply crumble about you. That if you state that one thing is not revealed truth, but is, in fact, wrong, then you have opened up the doors to questioning any and every part of this. And this is going to be a continuing struggle. But the rejection of the past, in fact, goes on so completely that even within the 17th century, you have reached that point, which was unthinkable 100 years earlier. In other words, the 17th century has done this enormous leap, in many ways, into the future. Science is off the ground and really running hard and fast. It is believed in. You have new philosophies with new concepts of how the universe works. The relationship of God to man has changed. The relationship of God to the universe. You've simply opened the doors to an entire new age. And just think of it. You are the products of that age. Ah, well...